Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marches never changed anything.
We'll be right back.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This, God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him, and then you felt like you wasn't worthy, and so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room, and I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me, and I said, I want you to do this graph for me, and that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Sewing machines are humming as these 15 workers at VCD Trading make high-end garments for women. There are not many garment manufacturers left in New York City because of lower labor costs in China and Asia. Now, with a new law that increases the minimum wage to $15 an hour, some owners say there may be even fewer.
Most of my workers average about between $11 to $13. And that's probably, in this industry, one of the higher ones. But now with the new law of $15 an hour minimum, you're raising the minimum wage from $8.75 to $15 in 3 years, which is 80%. I don't know how to sustain that.
Steve Hung is an immigrant from China by way of Vietnam. He is one of 70,000 small business entrepreneurs in New York City, where 52% of the small business owners are immigrants. His clients are niche name brands like the critically acclaimed brand The Row, owned by former child stars Ashley and Mary Kate Olsen. Hung says the U.S. government can help him compete against Chinese manufacturers.
If the government can make importing goods a little bit more expensive where the cost is not that big of a difference, then maybe that would help us out. If you're going to bring something in from another country and the duty on it was suffice that it's not as cheap as you think, then maybe Made in the USA will get a big kick.
Susie Leibowitz of a New York sportswear company appreciates having Hung's operation close by.
It just ends up being cheaper, faster, easier because you can communicate directly with the factory. You can just walk over if there's an issue and solve it. Made in the USA. It's a big selling point, and it's a really big selling point selling to international customers, oddly enough.
In New York, as in other American cities, immigrant-operated businesses give character to neighborhoods. This often happens in the business district, or Main Street, as it's called, says immigrant researcher David Kallick.
The areas, the restaurants, the grocery stores, the hair salons, the dry cleaners, the stuff that makes up the kind of the character of a neighborhood. And there we see that, so if in the country, around the country, there are 18% of all businesses are owned by immigrants, 28% of all Main Street businesses are owned by immigrants. So they're playing a big role there.
There are 4.9 million businesses in the U.S., but their survival rate is low. Just 50% survive 5 years or more, and only one-third stay open for more than 10 years. Bernard Schussman, VOA News, New York.
Come here in the morning. I don't know how many people's coming, what language they speak, and what help they need from me, but I'm ready for them. When they come from the detention center, they come first here. At least one van comes a day, but sometimes two, three vans. Last 2 weeks, like 70, 80 people. When they come inside, the first question is, where is the bus station? They don't tell the people this is the bus station.
At first, the men do not understand why they are dropped off at the gas station.
They are coming from everywhere, from Mexico, Bangladesh, China, Somalia. Most of the people, like 19, 20 years. Can you do me a favor? Can you reissue the ticket and send me on the 525 bus? Most of people doesn't have like even $1 in his pocket. Sometimes I pay for their ticket. Sometimes I give them food. I have to pay for them out of my pocket because I don't own the gas station. Sometimes I give my lunch, Indian food, from my house. Sure, you don't want anything to eat? Good. When they wait here, they want to talk with his family. You talk first, then give me. When I see someone talk his mom and dad after like 2 months, 3 months, that's feel really good. Most of people don't speak English.
Where is your family? Las Vegas? Los Angeles?
What's two? In India, I went to the restaurant and I see one poor man and he asked me for a food. I buy him a food and then when I went to the counter to pay, the owner of the restaurant, he wouldn't take money from me and he gave me a little note. It says, we don't charge for humanity. I try and live every day by what that note says.
I feel sad for them and I try to do my best, making sure they're comfortable.
Through immigration, it's very tough. It's not easy for me because my wife is a U.S. citizen.
I know what it feels to leave the family and start again in the new country with new people.
Yeah, your bus.
Most of people take the bus.
They are still not free before they get their home. I worry if other people continue to help them after they leave the gas station. Maybe
15 years, nobody needs help because everybody helps each other. I'm thinking to put sign outside, welcome to the little Ellis Island.
Something you may not know, Baltimore City has a large percentage of immigrant-owned businesses, even more than some other cities with similar immigrant populations.
11 News' Andre Hepkins joins us live tonight from South Point to show us how these entrepreneurs are factoring into Baltimore's business scene. Andre.
Kai, Adam, good evening. I'm standing here on Broadway a couple of blocks north of Eastern Avenue where you can literally see the signs of the fact that immigrants own a lot of businesses here in Baltimore. In fact, a few years back, the Fiscal Policy Institute did a study that showed that Baltimore is similar to cities like Philadelphia and Minneapolis when it came to the percentages of immigrants living in those cities. But when you looked at the percentages of immigrant-owned businesses, Baltimore outperformed those in other cities. And I've spent the past few weeks talking to immigrants in the city who own businesses, and they've impressed me with their personal stories about their drive to succeed. And that passion is pumping a lot of energy into Baltimore's economy.
She was born Svetlana Moros. She's now known as Lana Brown. Lana owns Flor de Lis, a florist shop on Baltimore's Liberty Street. Economic freedom is what she found in the USA, something she couldn't get in her home country of Russia.
Because in Russia, if you don't bribe people, authorities, you can't do much of anything.
But here, her dreams flourished, and the fruits of her labor have generated jobs for other immigrants, including Sabrina Lee. She left China 5 years ago. Here, the Maryland Institute College of Art graduate is planting seeds for her own entrepreneurial dreams.
I really want to, like, open my own graphic design studio.
I was dreaming to have my own business, and, you know, and I never thought it would happen, but it did happen. And it makes you very proud, feel proud.
A 2014 study by Baltimore City and the Able Foundation found that 7% of the people living in the city were born outside of the United States, but immigrants owned 21% of Baltimore's businesses.
The owner of Green Lime Cleaning is telling her workers how to clean the floors in this Pikesville home. Alejandra Ivanovich is originally from Venezuela.
My mom brought us to Florida the year Chavez took office.
Alejandra's family fled Hugo Chavez in 1999. The single mother escaped an abusive relationship in Florida, then rebounded in Baltimore, where she found opportunity through business ownership.
I want my kids to be proud of me and to see that there is nothing that can happen to you that will make you, that will stop you.
At this Latino Network Providers Monthly meeting, sponsored by Esperanza Center of Catholic Charities, we talked to organizers about immigrant grit as a source for success.
Most people that we talk to at the Esperanza Center are fleeing either really terrible poverty in their home countries or are fleeing violence.
Many of these new Americans have found homes in Baltimore's Highlandtown neighborhood. Here along Eastern Avenue, you'll see many faces from different places who are breathing life into once vacant spaces.
Places in Highlandtown are full of new businesses. There's families all over the place. And there's just a lot of vibrancy and economic activity that new immigrants bring to any part of the country that they come to. And Baltimore is a great example.
Love this country with all of my heart, that I am so grateful for all the good things it has given me.
And I met Alejandra at a Latino Providers Network event. It's a monthly event that's sponsored by the Esperanza Center of Catholic Charities a couple of blocks up. They tell me they help about 20% of Baltimore's immigrants assimilate into this city. Live in Fells Point, I'm Andre Hepkins, WBAL TV 11 News.
Great to see that impact, Andre. Thank you so much.
What's up, everybody? I am Jaspreet Singh, and welcome to The Minority Mindset. You've heard the stereotypes that Indians drive taxis, they own motels, and they run convenience stores. I mean, you remember Apu from The Simpsons, right? Thank you, come again. Come on, I know you remember. Well, it's more than just a stereotype. There's a lot of truth to this. But have you ever wondered why that's the case? Out of all the business possibilities in the world, every time you hop into a cab or you go to your local convenience store, Why is there an Indian person working there? So in this video, I want to talk about that immigrant mindset of coming to a new country and building yourself financially. And to be fair, I can only speak from what I've seen. My family comes from a small state in India called Punjab, so I can't speak for everybody. Now, to really understand this, we gotta back up a little bit and see why people from India are even coming to America. When people leave their native homes to go to a new country, it's usually for one sole purpose: to have a shot at a better life. In some countries, it can be very hard to get ahead. Like in some places, your success or your lack of success is determined by what family you're born into. And I'm not saying like, oh, your dad's rich, so you're gonna be rich. No, I mean like if you have a certain last name, you won't be able to go to certain schools or hold certain jobs just because of what your name is or what family you're from. Excuse me, what's your name, sir? John Smith. Smith, huh? Smith, oh, sorry, we don't hire Smiths here. Plus, you don't always have the same opportunities and resources that you do here in America. So now you have this big dream in your mind of going to this new country where anybody can be successful, and then you make the decision. You're gonna make the move. But it's not so simple. You're not just packing a bag and then saying, bye mom and dad, I'll see you over the holidays. No, you don't know if or when you'll ever get to see your friends and family again. For one, moving to a new country isn't cheap. Who knows what land you had to sell or how much debt you had to take on just so you can make the move. It's kind of like how college kids have to figure out a way to pay for these crazy spring break vacations. You're not making any money in college, and who knows if you're ever gonna make money after you graduate, but people keep finding a way to pay for these vacations, and sometimes it's with the help of student loans. And in this case, you're going for a long, long, long time. Two, you gotta say bye to everything and everyone that you love. Bye, delicious Indian food. And three, you're going to a new country where a lot of times you don't know the language, you don't know anybody, and you don't know the culture. Like, take baseball for example. People in America love baseball, but in baseball, you have these rounded bats, and then you swing at the ball with this form. In India, you have something similar, but you don't hold a rounded bat. You hold a flat bat, and you swing like this. But you got a dream in your mind, and you got to be willing to go through these changes to make it happen. So now you're getting ready for this journey, and you get on the plane with your suitcase and a little bit of cash in your pocket, and you take this 20-hour journey to America, and you get off the plane, and you're like, what the heck do I do now? I know, I'll eat at the American McDonald's. And that's when you realize, oh crap, it costs money to eat and survive, so then people start working wherever they can just so they can make ends meet. And that applies even if you have a professional degree. Like, personally, I know a handful of people who came from India to America as doctors. Like, they had medical degrees, but they had to work as janitors or at factories just so they could afford food. And you know how some people say that if you want to be financially sound, you should aim to save and invest 20% of your income? Well, it's kind of different when you come from India because, for one, anytime you get a paycheck, a big chunk of it is going back to India to support your family. And then you gotta remember why these people came to America for the first place. It was for a shot at a better life. So instead of saving and investing 20% of their income, they try to live off of 20 or 30% of their income and save every dollar and penny that they have left. Huh, that might explain why us brown people are so cheap. When I was young, my dad told me that there's no such thing as sick days because you can't afford that. You work pretty much 7 days a week, and you only get a handful of days off a year, and that's including holidays. You might have to work multiple jobs, and then having 2 days off in a row, like a Saturday and a Sunday, is considered a long vacation. You're going to work early in the morning, you're not coming home until late at night, and then you're spending as little as possible just so you can save up for something bigger. Remember, they're coming here just because of a dream that they had. So now you're making a little bit of money, and you're saving money, and then naturally, you're going to start meeting people with the same background as you because they understand you and it's easy to communicate with them. Ah, finally somebody who can understand my accent. And as you start meeting these other people, you start learning about what they did to build themselves financially. And for a lot of Indian people who either did not pursue higher education or who wanted to do something creative, it's either driving a cab or a taxi, running a motel, or owning a convenience store. Why? Because they want something they can own and control because it's work in and results out. And to be completely honest, I don't know why it's these few specific things. I think it's because the first few people that came from India, they started either one of these things, and then this information just got passed down from one generation to the next. So then you take all this money that you've been saving up, and then you look at what guidance you have around you, and then you pick a path. And then you invest everything that you have into this business, and it becomes your new job, your life insurance, and your retirement plan all in one. And then you do this for a long time while keeping the same work ethic with no days off and busting your butt, and then you raise a family, and you tell your kids, you have to become successful, so you need to become a doctor or an engineer, and yeah, that's where we are now, so we'll see where this cycle leads next. So why am I sharing this story with you? Well, hopefully inspires you to do something. If you have a dream, go for it. Nobody's going to do it for you, and now is the best time to start. And I want to know, is this story something you can relate to? Let me know in the comments below. If you enjoyed the video, hit that thumbs up button and share it with one friend so we can help spread the word. Don't miss our new videos on entrepreneurship, business, and money every single week. So hit the subscribe button and the notification bell. That way you actually find out when our new videos are released. And as always, keep hustling.
I went through every major European country. There wasn't one second where I thought that I wanted to be anywhere other than the U.S. I grew up in Bombay in India. It's now called Mumbai. And I came to the U.S. in August of 1969. I felt that the U.S. was by far ahead of any other country in terms of not just the level of knowledge and the quality of the colleges and universities here, but also the entrepreneurial culture in the U.S. and the freedom and openness in the U.S. to sort of be the best that you can be. The first thing I remember is both a cultural challenge and a financial challenge. The financial challenge was the fact that I left India with a very small amount of money. I had less than $2.50 when I arrived in Pittsburgh. So the first challenge was to get a student loan. The U.S. At that time, perhaps even now, has a great scheme called the Council for International Visitors. So I was, in a sense, adopted by a Pittsburgh family through the Council of International Visitors, and they put me up for the first 4 or 5 days so I could get acclimatized to the great differences between the U.S. and India. Foreign students like me were still seen as a curiosity. The universities themselves were getting their first experience with what this batch of international students could actually achieve, either academically or in business. It was both more difficult and more exciting because we kind of thought ourselves, subconsciously anyway, as trailblazers. My ability to make the first US dollar was probably more difficult than that of many because I've never worked for an employer. In my case, something happened to me in those 2 years that I was getting my master's and my PhD, and I was bitten by the entrepreneurial bug. So I had to go raise a tiny amount of capital, around $30,000. That was the first capital that went into my first company. It was very difficult to raise, naturally, because I had no track record as an entrepreneur. You know, I had only come to the U.S. a few years earlier. But from that, I began to get a paycheck, which, if I remember right, was about $1,000 a month. But it felt great because it was my own company paying me. And it was about 3 or 4 years into that company that it just felt like the U.S. was home. It wasn't always an easy ride. In fact, it was rarely an easy ride. I've gone through hundreds and hundreds of obstacles in my business career, but at each point I felt that it wasn't just about the desire to make a fast buck. It was all about honor, integrity, trying to do the right things for customers, trying to do the right things for shareholders, and trying to do the right things for employees. And that's always been my belief, that if you do the right things, that you're going to end up building a good company and the financial rewards will just be there.
Two Ferraris, two Bentleys, a brand new Rolls. Not exactly the cars you'd expect to see in the driveway, but the guy who used to pump your gas. But when an Indian immigrant traded his small village for Big Apple ambition, he managed to turn a single service station into a billion-dollar behemoth. Meet Harry Singh.
Going on. My name is Harry Singh. I'm the president of Bola Oil Corp. I'm a company of convenience stores in Long Island, New York.
Taking care of some deep cleaning, store's doing good.
I started this company from one gas station, 4 mechanics, 2 cashiers, 6 people, and I grew this company into now $1 billion company just in 25 years.
Great job.
Over the last 5 years alone, Bola Oil Corp has made combined revenues of $3.3 billion. Yeah, billion, with a B.
No, I did not have a dream that I would ever be a millionaire.
And how could he, when he started out with next to nothing?
I was born and grown up in a small village called Surampur in Punjab, India. About 1,500 people population consists of all farmers. And I always had a desire to migrate to the greatest country of the world, in the United States of America.
So Harry scraped together $50, said goodbye to small town farming, and struck out for New York City.
First day I landed here in the most famous city of the world, in New York. I was somewhat scared, but not knowing what I was going to do to make a living.
But guys like Harry don't let a little fear get in the way, so he kicked his job search into high gear.
I started driving a taxi, which I heard from people they were making good money. When I used to take my car for repairs, most of the repair shop you go to, you waited in the line to get your car serviced. You know, there's always cars waiting to get work done.
While his fellow cab driver saw an annoyance, Harry saw an opportunity.
So I decided to go to school to qualify as an auto mechanic. And once I'd done my certification, I bought my first station in Brooklyn. This is the repair shop where I started working 25 years ago. Being a mechanic, fixing cars, getting dirty was no surprise to me. Whatever it takes. I had to find a way to build a new customer base. I learned by cross-promoted. When people were shopping at us for gasoline, we give them coupons and promotions to bring them in to get their oil change done, get their brake job done, get their tune-ups done. And it was successful. I brought home $76,000. That was my first year annual income. And we continued to save whatever we could save from the business. I bought my second station, third station, fourth station. Within the first 5 years, I had about 8 sites, and I continued moving forward, doing very well in growing and building, buying new stations.
But a change in the auto repair industry threw a wrench into Harry's budding empire. Newer high-tech cars meant fewer breakdowns, and when they did need fixing, they went back to the dealer.
In 2001, that was one of the worst years in auto repairs for us. We lost 15% in the auto repair side of the business. When I first started, gasoline was never a main way making money for the business. The auto repair was the place that made the most amount of money. We had to continue find those revenues. I was definitely very stressed, kind of put me and shook up me up, and I don't know where to go from there. I went looking for another opportunity. So we started building convenience store in 2002. Because convenience store was a new thing, new offering on a gas station that had worked in other states. This station was consist of repair shop and auto accessories. There was no food, no coffee, or no snacks were sold here. Today, space that basically made no money. Today, this space generates anywhere about $40,000 to $50,000 a monthly in sale.
But 50 grand a month is pocket change compared to Harry's big idea. Opening his own fuel distribution center.
Bola Oil Corporation was created in 2004, so we could have bought purchased product at the best cost available in the market by becoming a wholesale distributor.
When you control every aspect of your business, low costs mean huge profits. Yeah, Harry's a pro at making money, but he's even better at spending it.
This is my home, beautiful built, custom, 22,000 square feet. You can call it a house, you can call it a mansion. Grand Sales, engineered and designed in the U.S. and built in Spain, and brought in one piece, all hand molded. We spent close to $1 million in the total stairways that's been hand-carved. Fireplace that came from Italy. You have 20 karat gold leaving. Artwork done on the walls. You look at some artworks that was done by very special artists that we brought across the world, have done our work in Rome Vatican, restoring the Michelangelo work. Another special room in a house we call a formal party room, a beautiful bar, game room. This party room, we probably put in over $1 million plus building, furnishings, beautiful stonework. The second most important space in the house, this special secret room. That this car garage where I put my favorite two Ferraris and Rolls Royce, couple of Bentley. We basically designed this lift ramp for us, so which will allow us to put the car on the lift, take the cars downstairs, and park the three cars downstairs. So now three car garage basically become in a six car garage. I have enjoyed being successful. This country is a land of opportunities. I left my country to better my life, and I've been very pleased. I can't tell you how humbly I'm appreciated having that opportunity in this country to be what I am today.
Today's podcast is titled 11,000 Kilometers to the Promised Land in Black Neighborhoods. Once again, 11,000 Kilometers to the Promised Land in Black Neighborhoods right here in the United States of America. Now, on our, if you're online and you go to Blog Talk Radio, in our scrolling marquee, we've got maps of where it illustrates is, you know, how long does it take to get, I mean, not how long does it take, what's the distance in kilometers from various places, like from, there's a map on there from Manila to New York City, a map from, you know, the distance between Mexico City and Chicago, Illinois. There's another map on there from the distance between Saudi Arabia and Detroit, Michigan. I think there's one map on there from someplace in all the way to St. Louis, Baltimore, Maryland, Washington, D.C. Anyway you cut it, these people are traveling great distances to start businesses. And just on, let's see, before we go back to, because I got some more clips for you. Okay. Let me see. Let me get this in order. Okay. Immigrant entrepreneurs start 17% of all new businesses in the United States and represent 13% of all business owners. Of a total income of about 12% generated by immigrant business owners. There are about 2 million black-owned businesses in the United States. Now, it didn't break down the distinction of black, but let's just say, well, black, because that can be African-American or Nigerian. According to the most recent available census data, there are more than 2 million black-owned businesses in the United States. All right, let's see. There are 3.2 million immigrants. All right, about 3.2 million immigrants ran their own businesses, making up one out of every five entrepreneurs in the country. That's about 20%. Immigrant-owned businesses employed almost 8 million American workers and generated $1.3 trillion in total sales. So they own about a million more businesses than black folks. Of course, we have to define what's black, but I'm just keeping it simple. And generated $1.3 trillion in total sales. sales. Let's go back to our audios.
President Trump raised eyebrows this week when he claimed he shares the same ideas on immigration as Texas political icon Barbara Jordan. Jordan is a revered figure with statues honoring her legacy on the UT campus and at Austin's airport. The Democrat became the first African-American woman to serve in the Texas Senate and the first woman to serve Texas in Congress. Jordan is remembered for her eloquence and her sense of justice and ethics. Some people see Barbara Jordan as the complete opposite of Donald Trump, so it took many folks by surprise when he compared his views to hers. On Wednesday, the president posted a message on the White House website saying Jordan backed common sense reforms and said his America First approach to immigration is in the spirit of Jordan's vision. Jordan led a bipartisan commission on immigration reform in the 1990s. She spoke about the commission's work in 1995, just a few months before her death.
We have concluded that a properly regulated legal immigration system is in the national interest. We support the basic framework of current policy, but I said properly regulated, and I mean that. Immigration is not a right guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution to everyone anywhere in the world who thinks they want to come to the United States. Immigration is a privilege. It is a privilege granted by the people of the United States to those we choose to admit. But this is not a mere favor that we grant to people because we're generous. We're a generous nation, yes. But immigration is in our national interest. We admit that. It is in our national interest to unite families and create economic growth and protect those who flee persecution.
The Jordan Commission called for ending immigration for low-skilled workers, enhanced border security, and preventing businesses from hiring people in the country illegally. President Trump says that's what he wants to do, too. But does his vision really match up with Barbara Jordan's? For perspective, we turn to Ruth Wesom, a professor of policy practice at the LBJ School of Public Affairs.
At the time, 20 years ago, you had a strong push in the country to increase legal immigration, as well as those, much like today, there were people who would decrease legal immigration. So Barbara Jordan was driving that lane down the middle, trying to bring people together. If you look at the Jordan Commission recommendations, they also include modifications to the employment-based system and a robust refugee program. Modifications to employment-based would have been increasing the authorities of the Department of Labor to go after other kinds of violations, as well as it was the Jordan Commission that originated what we now call E-Verify. They saw one of the ways to deal with foreign workers coming in and displacing U.S. workers, which has always been an issue, or at least a political issue. They saw the way of doing that is to create a system that's easy to use by employers. And we have that system today that any employer in this country can use if they choose. In terms of putting it in the national interest, you've got to remember that when Barbara Jordan talks about something in the national interest, think about that a second. What would Barbara Jordan think the national interest was? And is Barbara Jordan someone who's likely to be on the same page as President Trump when it comes to national interest? To me, that's a big question. I don't think that they would use the term national interest in the same way because they're coming at the question from two very different perspectives.
After Jordan's death, plans for comprehensive immigration reform fell apart during the second term of President Bill Clinton. Efforts for reform during the George W. Bush administration fell by the wayside in the wake of 9/11.
Ramsey personality Chris Hogan, number one best-selling author of the book, Retire Inspired, joins me this hour as we talk to millionaires. Everyday Millionaires Theme Hour. And, man, we enjoy talking to these folks. Ashish is with us to start us off in Chicago. Hey, Ashish, what is your net worth?
Hey, Dave. It's a pleasure talking to you.
You too. What's your net worth,
sir? My net worth is $1.2 million.
Very cool. Good. And tell me how that's broken down. What's that invested in?
It's 600 in retirement funds, 115 stocks and mutual funds. I have an equity of about 250 on my house, equity of 50,000 on a rental property. I have 60,000 in my emergency funds, and then 70,000 in a 529 plan.
You are killing it. Well done. So how old are you?
Thank you. My wife and I, we both are 38 years old.
Oh, man, you're way ahead of schedule. So how much of this $1.2 million is there because you inherited it?
$0.
Okay, very good. So you completely did this yourself by 38 years old. So what has been your income range, your household income, like your lowest point and your highest point?
So Dave, my wife and I, we came in this country in 2008, and at that point of time, our combined household income was $60,000.
Mm-hmm.
This year, we would have a combined household of roughly about $300,000.
Very cool. What do you guys do for a living?
I am a technical director for one of the insurance companies, and my wife works as a manager for one of the airline companies in Chicago.
Very cool. So what's your degree in?
We both have a master's in computer applications.
Okay, very cool. And your GPA?
We did our education outside of U.S., so we don't really have the concept of GPA, but the equivalent would be about 3.
Okay, got it. And how much of this money is here because you borrowed money to create wealth?
The only thing we have borrowed for is our house,
mm-hmm.
which we have the mortgage on, and the rental property. And Dave, to be honest, a couple of years back when I started listening to your show, we had done some mistakes, to be honest. We had car loans on both of our cars. That was the first thing which we paid off because we had cash ready with us, but for some reason we were still keeping our car loans on.
Mm-hmm.
So we did borrow the money on the car loans a couple of years back. But since the time we started listening to your shows, we don't have anything borrowed besides a house.
Right. You said you immigrated to the country. Where did you grow up?
We grew up in India.
India? Okay.
And we came here for work.
Gotcha. Okay. Because I read a statistic a while back that that I believe to be true. It's an old statistic, and so I don't know if it's accurate today. It's probably a 40-year-old statistic, but it said that people who come to this country legally from another country are 4 times more likely to end up being millionaires than one of us who grew up here, because you came here because of the opportunity, and by God, you're going to take advantage of it. Would that be true in your case?
I completely agree with you, Dave.
And let me ask you this. Would your cultural upbringing have been an advantage when you came to America, or a disadvantage as far as building wealth? I mean, were there some good things that you learned, you know, growing up in your culture that worked to your advantage when you came here, or some things that held you back?
So that is what I was going to mention. To be honest, while I did not inherit any of the funds from my parents, or the fortune from my parents, or from my household, but the thing which really helped out us as couples was the fact that our upbringing always gave us a value for money. So I remember even when the age of 23, 24, when I started my first job back in India, the first thing my father did at that point of time was to sit with me and divide my income to all different buckets of spends along with the savings. So from day one, from my first paycheck, there was a push for me to save money.
Mm.
And that's what really helped as a culture. And my dad always used to say, and even now he says, in his entire life, he's 78 years old, he has never borrowed a single penny.
Mm-hmm.
Even the house he built was completely on his cash. So for him, the concept of me borrowing the money for the house itself was something which he was not very comfortable with.
Right. So even that kind of debt, he went bananas on. He didn't like it. So let me ask you this. Is that particular to your family, or do you feel like that was a cultural norm that would be different?
I personally would say that this is, I have seen this more as a cultural shift, and some of the Asian countries which had this strong value, it's kind of mellowing down a little bit, but still when I compare to the American and some of the Western cultures, the feeling of savings and the power of the money and the power of savings is still a little stronger, and the value imbibed is a little stronger. Compared to some of the Asian countries, what we have.
It's a good discussion. It's good. It's a good thing to explore, Chris.
It really is. I see. Do you do any giving?
I do. We do not do as much as we would like to, what Dave suggests. But we do try to do as much as we can, both over here, as well as back to in our country as well.
Okay, very good. And I have to ask you, what's the most you've ever paid for a pair of jeans?
Roughly about $30.
Okay, all right. And did you ever buy a new car prior to becoming a millionaire?
We bought a minivan 2 years back, and that was the one which we took the loan on. But before that, all the cars we have purchased have been pre-owned.
Okay, Ashish, tell me, you do have kids, right?
We do have two daughters.
Okay, I was going to say, because if you bought a minivan and didn't have kids, we were going to have to talk. So I'm glad you got kids, my friend. Congratulations. Proud of you.
Very cool. Very well done. It's a good discussion. And here's the thing. Chris, I have I started noticing this many years ago. I had a lady call me that was German and came here right after World War II. Her husband was actually in the German Army in World War II. So if you came to the United States right after World War II with a German accent, you were not a popular person.
Right.
I mean, as you can imagine. And so her husband was killed in the war, and she came to the United States to set a new future for her kids. And when you set, when you have a long-term goal that's beyond your own life, when you live like no one else, to be able to live like no one else, there's something about, you know, if you're willing to pick your family up, completely uproot out of the culture of your upbringing, change languages, often be a religious minority, often do all of that sacrifice in order to get opportunity, you take advantage of that opportunity.
Oh, absolutely.
You treasure it.
Yes.
The Statue of Liberty means something in
sure
the harbor.
Does. Well, they're not going to squander it. I mean, there's too much on the line, Dave.
And I can, you know, as a redneck hillbilly, I can take a lesson from that.
I can, too.
I can go, hey, this is the land of the free.
Yes.
This is the home of the brave.
Yes.
I can do this.
Yes. And you know I'm working on this next book project, and it's one of those things that I keep going to saying to myself, the American dream is still available. Don't anybody dare tell you that it's not possible, you can't do it, or you shouldn't do it. That's a lie. And it's one of those things I get excited hearing these people that have sacrificed. Like you said.
Well, he's not been here just a little over 10 years.
And has hit $1.2 million.
Yep.
So you someone.
So why not me?
That's right.
You know?
Right. Absolutely. Where you don't have a language barrier. You didn't have to learn the language. You were grown here in America, where opportunity is on every corner.
And that's almost a problem. It's almost a thing. You can squander something that you take for granted. You feel entitled.
Well,
all of us. I mean, I can look at myself and say that, and you know, not as much because I'm a go-getter capitalist pig. I believe in this stuff.
Right.
But you know, the reason we do this hour for you folks listening, Chris and I, is we have come to believe that it is harder for some people than others, but it's possible for almost everyone.
That's a perfect way to put that.
I mean, there's all the isms, racism, sexism, hillbillyism. You know, you can get put down or pushed back or oppressed for anything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's people who won't put me on the radio because they think I'm broadcasting from a double wide. So that's hillbillyism, right? I get held back. So, but I mean, you can be put down, pushed back, oppressed by anybody from any people group, and some people have more of that than others that they have to overcome. But we are finding people that are overcoming all the isms.
Yes, they are. On a daily basis, Dave.
And it's just exciting.
It is exciting.
Because it means you can do it, too.
It's available.
You can do it.
Yes.
It's doable. Everyday Millionaires Theme Hour. Back with more of these real stories from real people. Not theories from the news channel. Not someone who's writing a blog in their mother's basement. This is real life, boys and girls. This is the Dave Ramsey Show.
All right, today's podcast is titled 11,000 Kilometers to the Promised Land in Black Neighborhoods. Thank you, Beasley, for inspiration for this one. And we're going to make this a regular series. At least once a week, we're going to do, let's call it 11,000 kilometer immigrants who have come here to the United States and have started businesses. So we're going to do at least once a week on that, and then thank you, Bianchi, also for at least two or three times a week we'll do the Black Entrepreneur thing. Now, I'm going to play a clip before we go to the phone lines that I played several times before, but in the backdrop of all these immigrant stories, because we've probably featured two big immigrant billionaires in our clips today, a handful of millionaire or million-dollar businesses or thousand-year businesses today, including a couple that have been here for 10 years and have their net worth of $1.2 million via the Dave Ramsey, the last clip. But in the light of, this is just a question I'm putting out there, but, you know, let's target this towards Evanston, Illinois, which we talked about them last week. Evanston, Illinois has passed their version of a reparations bill. Okay, Asheville, North Carolina is working on something like that, but Asheville, Illinois has actually passed one. So my question to you guys is this: should the people that are wholeheartedly believe in reparations for African Americans, ADOS, African descendants of slaves, and you know, in the context of let's put it in the context. Let's narrow this down to what they have done in Evanston, Illinois, so far. Now they passed the bill. They haven't cut any. And their reparations starting out will be in the form of, what do they call it? Housing reparations. Yeah. Anyway, they've passed the law. Now they haven't instituted it yet, but it's two things that are coming out for starters. Number one, you can receive up to $25,000 as a down payment for a home if you meet the certain qualifications for reparations, housing reparations, in Evanston, Illinois. Okay, up to $25,000 down payment and or up to $25,000 in repairs on your home if you meet the qualifications for these reparations in Evanston, Illinois. They've passed that. Okay, now, should we concentrate on reparation programs like that or take a closer look and model what these immigrants have done, because they've traveled, 11,000 kilometers, 10,000 kilometers, 7,000 kilometers, 13,000 kilometers. I mean, they've come from Saudi Arabia to Detroit. That's why I put the maps up in our scrolling marquee on Blog Talk Radio there. You got these maps here. I mean, Mexico City to Chicago. When I flew up to Chicago a couple of years ago, I flew out of, Orlando, Florida, all right? But the people that boarded the plane before me were like families of Latinos, all right? And I went up there to visit two black townships, and I've heard, I didn't see any Latinos in the two towns that I was in Pembroke, Illinois, and Hopkins Park, but I heard they're there. I heard they're there. And they are well represented at the tax sale that happens a lot. I think once a year up in that neck of the woods in Illinois, they're well represented at the tax sale. Where you can pick up properties. I know somebody, she spent about $2,000 to pick up a parcel up at this particular sale, Kankakee County tax sale. All right. But the maps on our scrolling marquee from, like, the guy who, I think he's 38 years old, not an old guy at all, sort of say a young man, not a spring chicken, but a young man. 38 years old, the guy who hit the woman, the Asian woman who happened to be Filipino, okay. Now, he's living in a shelter, and he's got maybe some mental illness. I don't know all that, but 38, black male, he's the one that attacked the lady, and of course, according to our American justice system, innocent until proven guilty, regardless of what you saw on the video tape. But she came from Manila. I mean, well, she's Philippines. I don't know which city in the Philippines, but more than likely she flew out of Manila because you can either fly, I think, Cebu or Manila. I've been to the Philippines. So I flew in Manila, into Manila, and then I flew back out of Manila. That's a long flight. I spent a total of 23 hours up in the air. Not all at one time, you know, but it's a long haul stretch, trust me. So she came over 13,000 kilometers, something like that, to New York. All right. Now, she happened to, we don't know, I don't know her whole backstory yet, but so these people have come over in, I mean, and a lot of them, although they might not live in a black neighborhood, they certainly do set up businesses in black neighborhoods. So that's why I put those maps up on our scrolling marquee, so you can actually see the distances that they have traveled. And a lot of them, like I say, they might not live in a black neighborhood, but quite a few. And you know what? I can imagine, what time is it right now? It's 11:40 a.m. Eastern Standard Time where I'm at right now. So depending on where you're at in China or Southeast Asia, it's about 12 hours, you know, about 11:40 p.m. there. And depends on what part of Southeast Asia or Asia that you're in. 12-hour difference, in some places 13-hour difference, 10-hour difference, what have you. Here's an analogy I'm putting out there. You know, if you've ever gone to an Amway meeting back in the day, I don't know if they still have Amway, or a Mary Kay meeting, I don't know if they still have Mary Kay consultants. Well, you go to their opportunity meetings. I'm sure that there's some people that went to an opportunity meeting and painted a lovely picture of life in the United States or Canada and how much money you can make and how I was a dishwasher, or me and my wife were on the verge of, divorce, family breakup, and then we went to Detroit, and we were able to get a gas station or a convenience store, and now we've got a chain of them. There are opportunity meetings that have happened a little bit earlier. Well, over there, it's evening. Okay. Or you know what? That's in Southeast Asia, you know, Cambodia, Vietnam, Philippines, China, Thailand, those places. But in Saudi Arabia, they might be having opportunity meetings. Matter of fact, let me check the time. Okay. Or Kenya. Or Nigeria, let me just see. Right now it is, oh, come on. All right. In West Kenya, Homa Bay, Kenya, it is 6:42 p.m. There's a bunch of people sitting in an opportunity somewhere meeting somewhere in Kenya talking about how much money that they have made sitting there with their trinkets on and dressed well, and, you know, they got a slideshow of how well they've done in Detroit or Baltimore or Boston or St. Louis. Is 43 there. Let's go to London. What time is it in London right now? All right, it's 4:43, a little bit early. Okay, so they're not having no opportunity meeting there yet. And then you got this COVID thing too. Let's see. In Kiev, Ukraine, 6:43 p.m., somebody's having an opportunity meeting. The wonderful opportunities, how I went from struggling. I was struggling here in Kiev, Ukraine. But, you know, I have an associate. He's from Ukraine. He's over here now selling solar products. So, and in Ukraine, matter of fact, I mentioned Ukraine and Russia, two different countries. But one of the common languages they do have is Russian, although you have Ukrainian too, which is also another language. But you go to places like Pittsburgh, the state of Pennsylvania, you'll run into Russians or Ukrainians. New York State, that have come over here and started businesses and doing well. Okay. In any event, let's take, before I go to the phone lines, and once again, our topic today is 11,000 kilometers to the promised land in black neighborhoods. Let's go to Ballin' on Baltic, which basically is about immigrants who have come over here and literally playing Monopoly on the Baltic avenues and the Mediterranean avenues in real life.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon, which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. I mean, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo, because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look. Last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been. And has any positive change comes to the streets of Baltimore after the riots? And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time. And he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale, and that they were only selling for just $5,000 a piece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude. That bitch scared, nigga. Oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She drug you, motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass.
That nigga can't. That nigga hurting himself.
You from Nuke State.
It's over. It's over.
What
I say is over. Everybody get the fuck out of here.
Man, I'm fucking let's go across the street.
I ain't caught it. I'll slap the fuck out of one of y'all.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments, and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you could do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns, because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations, like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield. See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that, because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-WAC movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-civil rights movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them, which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place, there's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087 this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you gotta own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're gonna have with most of the people around you. Thank you.
Today's podcast is titled 11,000 Kilometers to the Promised Land and Black Neighborhood, 619-768-2945 is the call-in number. I'm going to play one last clip for this live stream, and I got a question to ask. You're about to hear the store owner of the store where George Floyd died outside of, the store owner, who happens to be an immigrant, I believe, is immigrant. So my question, I guess the question of the day here would be, would George Floyd be alive if he was the store owner instead of a consumer?
We are just 26 days away from the trial of one of the officers who ended up responding, Derek Chauvin. That will begin, again, in 26 days as we get you ready for that trial, because we will have gavel-to-gavel coverage right here on Court TV, cameras inside the courtroom, microphones in there. You'll see all the evidence. You will hear the testimony and the arguments made in that case and ultimately the verdict. So tonight, Court TV legal correspondent Chanley Painter was in Minneapolis and had an opportunity to go inside Cup Foods and speak with the owner at length and really get a better idea for the neighborhood, the better idea of the store and the impact and that day. Let's take a look.
Cup Foods is a very family-oriented neighborhood convenience store. We've been here since 1989. It's been my first and only job. We know almost all of our customers. We know customers that are now grandparents that were teenagers when they first started coming here. We know a lot of family members and kids and relatives that are loyal and continue to do business with us because of how well we have a relationship with them.
Why did your family choose this location to set up shop?
It was a closed-down pharmacy. It was a Wilhelm drugstore before us, and they just seen potential, and they kind of just put their trust and went forward with it. It was always pretty multicultural, very diverse, pretty peaceful, and it was just a friendly neighborhood community. You know, first names, nicknames, last names, you'd be surprised.
Take us back to May 25th, 2020. What was that day like?
Well, Floyd came in here. His associate came in the store first and tried to purchase some tobacco products and used a counterfeit bill. And the clerk noticed that it was a counterfeit bill right away and gave the bill back to him and told him that it wasn't a real bill. And at that point, he left out of the store. And then a few minutes later, Floyd entered the store. He had phone service through the store. He came in and he purchased some tobacco products with a counterfeit bill as well.
He may have not known that it was a counterfeit bill,
which happens often.
Did you know George Floyd?
I did. I didn't know him as well as I know a lot of other customers, but I did know him. I did recognize him. And from the times that we've, you know, had conversations, never had an issue with him.
Mahmoud, how did you find out what was happening right outside your front door here?
I got a phone call from my employee, and my employee said, hey, they're killing him. I got a little confused and concerned. I said, who are you talking about? She said, hey, they're killing him. So I told her to call the police on the police and record the incident. She did record it, but unfortunately she didn't call the police like I told her to.
You said call the police on the police. Why had that become a normal incident response for you?
There was an incident here in the past about 5-7 years ago where there was a cop that was harassing customers and harassing people that had nothing to do with the crime and the issues that were taking place, and eventually he got in trouble because somebody called the police on him. You know, calling the police shouldn't equate to a death threat or a death sentence to someone because of any crime, let alone a nonviolent crime.
What do you say to those who believe that but for your store calling 911 that night, George Floyd would still be alive?
We can only pray for him.
Look, we just want to make sure that, you know, that that everyone realizes that this was not a malicious call. This wasn't Rebecca in the park. This was a protocol. And even from that call that was placed here, it may have emanated here, but it should not have equated to the death of George Floyd or to any black man that is that has the police called on him. We hope that we are setting the tone for going forward what you what shouldn't happen when there's an interaction or some type of encounter with an officer. That black male, that brown male, should leave that encounter with his life.
I think that we've been an example for a lot of other businesses and places where patrons come in if they have either counterfeit bail or any kind of crime takes place. And I think Cut Foods now has kind of been the spotlight as to what can or could happen if the authorities are called on a person of color.
What has the last several months been like for you? I know that you tried to reopen once and then permanently reopened again in August of last year. How has this business been affected?
A lot of people said they were going to burn the store down, burn the city down, and it just was protected. It was a lot of the community members, specifically the ones that, you know, were our regular patrons, stood outside overnight and just protected our business and protected the whole community. It's just been everybody, every situation is different. Everybody's had their own agenda. A lot of people have been trying to find a justification for what happened, and when they have no one else to blame, they blame us.
They didn't tuck their tails and run like some business owners would, especially with the extreme death threats that Mahmoud received. They stayed steadfast with the community, because that's what the store is. This is a community store, and they stuck around. And I think that that has to speak volumes. And that's what CUP has been about, trying to make going forward, is try to create a healing space and create a healing process. I hope that the trial encompasses more healing. I think a guilty verdict goes a long way.
Tell us about some of the changes that you've made since George Floyd's death.
We definitely made sure. Police calls now are not going to be taken unless there's an actual violent crime taking place. We've been policing our own matters and training our employees that if the police ever need to be called, make sure it's done by a manager. We were here every day, you know, supporting the cause and being as supportive as we can, you know, giving out a lot of things too. Had a lot of produce giveaways and grocery giveaways and milk giveaways.
The commissioning of the mural.
The mural. For the most part, our community was very supportive of us. We had a lot of bystanders, a lot of people that want to come from all over the country.
Yeah.
We had a guy a couple weeks ago drive here from Houston and said, this is the first place I have to stop. And he just came in and took a look, took pictures and asked a few questions, and we get that on a day-to-day basis. Yeah.
CUP is not staying open in spite of anyone. CUP is a community-based store, has been for 31 years, 31 and a half years. This is why his father opened this store and was a great man, was a giving man. I remember that because I grew up in this store. I've seen the maturation of the store and of the community, and this is a thriving community that, in spite of this, will keep growing and keep surviving.
Your business has been in this community for more than 30 years. What do you think is the secret to its longevity?
Prayer and just being true to your customers and just being there for them and truly helping out those that are in need.
Mahmoud, what is justice for you in this case?
Justice is knowing you can call the authorities and not have to worry about somebody getting killed.
Mm.
Justice is no racial profiling. Justice is not having to worry about the color of your skin if the police are called. I mean, that's what justice really is. This is a country where you shouldn't have to worry about racial injustices. And unfortunately, we still have a lot of racism in this country, and until that's fixed, it's going to be something that's going to always have to hang around your head.
Again, our thanks to the folks at CUP Food for letting us in and to give America a better idea of that neighborhood, that store, and that day.
All right. Today's podcast titled 11,000 Kilometers to the Promised Land in Black Neighborhoods. We just heard the store owner of the last place where George Floyd, the late George Floyd purchased anything, died outside of that store. Here's some of the takeaways that I got from that clip we just played. You guys probably could have picked up more, but here are my five takeaways. Number one, now he's not an immigrant, but he's the grandson of immigrants. His grandparents came over to this country. And the second takeaway that I have is the store where George Floyd did whatever he did in there, and somebody called the police. It's the only job. Now, he's third generation. Talk about generational wealth. It's the only job that he has ever had. That says a whole lot right there. The only job that he has ever had is within his family business. A non-franchised convenience store, a family-owned business. Only job he's ever had, Generation 3. Next takeaway I got, and there are probably other takeaways, I'm just these are the ones that jumped out at me. When there was all the mayhem going on, the rioting going on in the town, the friends of the store, because it's a community store, his family, starting with his grandparents, going to his parents, and now him, prior to George Floyd meeting his demise there, had built up a lot of social capital. So while other buildings or businesses were vandalized, his business was protected. And that's where George Floyd expired. But his, due to the fact that the immigrants, starting with his grandparents, who taught his parents, and his parents taught him, they taught them how to build and maintain social capital. And you know what? I had to do some research on that. And like I said, we're going to feature at least one day a week on this topic of immigrants that have come over and set up shop in black neighborhoods. Well, not all exclusively black neighborhoods, but have come over here. It doesn't have to be exclusively black, but set up shop and have done well. But they built up, I mean, they're over 30 years of social capital. And, you know, part of that social capital is, okay, you don't have enough money, you know, come back and we'll get you, you know, squares away, stuff like that. Because they've stayed, I mean, they're not giving away the store, because if they did that, they wouldn't be in business for over 30 years. So they have obviously sound business policies that are, intact. And the last takeaway that I noticed that, and I heard this some time ago, that if there's an incident like George's, don't get the police involved. They'll settle it. You know, they'll handle it within the family. Because you got to imagine that now the son who's currently running the store, the face of the family, of that business, he probably, I don't know if his grandparents are still alive, but, you know, his parents are probably still alive. They had a powwow, and that's a policy that they set. You know, if it's short of a murder, you know, an armed robbery or something like that, something minor, like in the case of whatever Floyd did or didn't do, because I don't know, I wasn't there. Something minor, don't call the police. And I'll do some research by this time next week to find out where his grandparents immigrated from. But the question, well, this is the question of the day. Would George Floyd be alive today if grandparents started a family business that served the community 30 plus years ago, and George Floyd would have been behind the counter? A matter of fact, this owner of the business now, he wasn't even at the store when all this stuff went down. They had to call him up. But would George Floyd be alive today if he, as Pleasant Stephens would say, had a vested interest, his family had a vested interest in the community in the form of a convenience store, just like this one? Would he be alive today? I also will be doing research on how many black churches are in that neighborhood. And another takeaway that I picked up, this is six takeaway that I just picked up, was they bought into a location that had been previously closed down. It was a vacant building. So they had to take, why the building was vacant, what happened to the other business, I don't know that. And I can do some research on that as well. But they took a vacant building and they built it from scratch. And it's over 30 years now and running. And once again, the only job, his parents, you know, his grandparents probably had that vision. And that's the way you got to think when you're thinking about generational wealth. I want to start a family business where my grandsons or great-grandsons or great-great-grandsons or daughters, if they so choose, the only job that they'll ever have is working for the family. It's the only job he's ever had. So I'm going to do some research on how many black churches are in that neighborhood, how many black churches were around 30-plus years ago when that building first went vacant. But like I say, once a week, we'll zoom in on this. Tomorrow we've got a guest, thanks to Brother Pianchi, Robert Miner. He'll be in tomorrow. But anyway, we still got today. So anyway, 11,000 miles to the promised land of black neighborhoods, 619-768-2945. And like I say, if you go on our scrolling marquee on Blog Talk Radio, you'll be able to look at the various maps of the distance between Shenzhen, China, to different cities in the United States, Manila, Philippines, Saudi Arabia, Kenya, Africa, to I think Washington, D.C. Anyway, I got about 6 to 8 maps on there. And you can take a look at it. And then, they've been doing opportunity meetings. Because just like I say, I don't know if Amway's still around, but Amway, Mary Kay, when they do these Amway, these opportunity meetings for network marketing and whatnot, well, there are people around the globe that are having opportunity meetings to open up a store, open up a carryout, open up a gas station, open up a convenience store, open up a auto mechanic shop. There are opportunity meetings all around the globe of the opportunities within the black communities around the United States. And it is not limited to black folk now. They set up shop in white neighborhoods too. But I'm just saying, you know, can you nail shops? I imagine somewhere in South Korea and Vietnam, they've had opportunity meetings this past week and probably this weekend, and now with Zoom meetings, where you're going to be hearing women and men talk about how they were broke, they weren't making it, but then they discovered, man, I was struggling until I went to Baltimore or Philadelphia, New York City, and, you know, you see videos and presentations, maybe their YouTube channel or their nail salon in a straight-up black neighborhood. And then they show their, where they live, which is probably in another neighborhood. But you also have some that when they're starting out, you know, the shop is downstairs and they live upstairs, or they live in the back, or they live in the basement. I know of one story I read some years ago where this couple, they from Asia, they found a job working doing maintenance and housekeeping at a mall, and the people that owned the mall didn't know it, but that's where they lived. They lived in that mall for like 3 to 5 years. Nobody didn't know but them, this husband and wife. And when they finally moved out, they saved up enough money to open up their own thing, and later on they became millionaires. So anyway, every week we'll offer this. Let's go to our phone lines. Well, two questions I had. One was, I forgot the second one already, but the first one was, for the people that are interested in reparations, based on the Evanston, Illinois model that has already been approved, should those people in Evanston continue that form, reparations, or should we take a closer look at what these immigrants have done? Because they're immigrants in Evanston that are probably making $25,000 a week, all legally, than somebody if you get it down, if you want to buy a house in Evanston, if you can get through their hurdles, you get $25,000 credit for the down payment, or $25,000 worth of repairs on your home. Because in Evanston, you know what? That's another assignment I got to do. I'm going to find out how many immigrants own stores or businesses in Evanston, Illinois. Hopefully I'll have that by next week. This is Thursday, by next Thursday. And you know, we'll take notes. Who's got the liquor license? You know, and who wants the reparations? Anyway, let's go to our phone lines here. 314, your mic is open.
Did you get a hold of Samba?
Yeah, I called him, man. I keep on missing him because I called him yesterday right after I messed with you. And I'm going to call him again.
Yeah.
But mine is on
guess
for tomorrow. Yeah, mine is on for tomorrow,
whenever you have
Friday.
Whenever you have him guest on your show and you're not paying him, you better call him and see what their status is.
Yeah, I will. I talked to Miner yesterday. I'm going to talk to him again today. So he's scheduled for tomorrow. And then Samba We have, anyway, I'm going to call him again and go from there.
Yeah, he should be at that his spot today. But, you know, this thing with this, these illegal immigrants that the Democrats are letting into the country is totally ridiculous to me. Trump had the best plan. Why would you let people come into the country illegal and then get on government programs? And that costs over $115 billion a year. Over that was figures from about 3 years ago. It just don't make any sense. And I don't understand why come blacks don't, in particular, don't complain about that. I sent you another video on some.
I'm looking at it right now. I just pulled it up. Successful black students of another class.
Yeah. So that's my position on it. See, the stores that you in Minneapolis, those students there, they're not going to shop at that store. Those stores are for people that's in that particular economic status, poverty and so on and so on.
Correct.
And that's something you want to get away from. A lot of some people don't mind staying there. When you look at the politics, you have in St. Louis, you've elected some Black Lives Matter people into these positions, and they for Medicaid expansion. They for not funding charter schools. Yeah, I mean, just think about it. When you say that you're not for alternative schooling other than what the public schools offer, well, what's coming out of the public schools, then that means that you're selfish and you want to keep the status quo. Because as parents, even though they are poor, they are functional, and they are doing some marvelous things with their children like those there on that video, those children should not be confined to the present educational paradigms that they find themselves in. You can't keep all these folks. You can't keep everybody in one environment because they don't deserve to be there. They better than that.
Right.
And if you know, it's just like taking dirty clothes and putting it in the clothes in the clean clothes drawer. Sooner or later, the clean clothes are going to get dirty too. I mean, that's just
true.
A fact. So you got.
Yeah, I'm going to have to do a podcast on this separately. What you sent to Detroit, black engineers.
Yes. I mean, you can go and Google that name and you pull up several years of that. That type of performance. So that's the thing that I complain about. I'm not working to create no corner stores in no neighborhoods because those things ain't going to last long. And I'm with Barbara Jordan. The people that come to your country are supposed to add on to not take from. That stuff about going to another. Well, I tell you what. Let's take 100 blacks and take them to Vietnam, let them open up businesses there, or the Philippines. How do you think that would go over? They need stores. They eat food, don't they?
Man, there's a whole bunch of these little neighborhood stores over in the Philippines. There's a bunch of them.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that if there's a need, let's see if blacks can go over to the Philippines and open up some stores like you make mention of in these stories, these corner stores. Let's see if blacks can go to the Philippines and become and do plumbing jobs, put in toilets and blue collar jobs, or go to Vietnam, or go to Africa.
Well,
you know they
switch.
Need plumbing over there.
Yeah, definitely. There's opportunities there too, but
yeah. But what would be the drawback?
Well, you know what? Now, speaking of which, let's switch it over the continent, and I'm sure you've seen some of these videos too. There are people that have gone over to Africa, Ghana, Gambia, and other places in Africa, in hopes of opening up a business. And some have, but then others have come back to the States because they haven't adjusted culturally. Africa wasn't what they thought it would be.
Yeah, but these ones you talked about don't even speak the language. And they come in hundreds of thousands at a time.
That's the first thing. You got to be willing to learn the language. And a lot of them are assuming that the skin tone, your skin color will get you over. They haven't picked up. Well, I haven't been over there. You have. So what are your observations?
Well, I'm trying to get a point across. If these folks is coming here with all these skills, why come they're not developing where they come from?
Mm.
It's needed.
Right.
I mean, that's what I want to know. Why come blacks don't migrate to their country 100,000 at a time? You know, we talk about fair trade, which I'm for, or they talk about free trade, which I'm for fair trade. Well, mm-hmm. fair trade can also equate in immigration. Hey, if you got 100,000 and want to come to my country, then we're going to send 100,000 to your country. If you want to send $50,000 worth of potatoes to my country, then I'm going to send $50,000 worth of onions to your country. That's what you call fair trade.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always people want to dump on the United States. Nigerians reportedly, who numbers less than a million in the United States, from this report that I read,
mm-hmm.
they remit over $24 billion a year back to their country. I don't know how much Mexicans remit. Haitians was in the billions, too. So if you got that store there in Minneapolis, and the owners are remitting the excess back to where they come from.
Uh-huh.
Well, then why do we have these conversations and these arguments that the black dollar don't bounce like a basketball? The black dollar don't bounce in the black neighborhood as many times as it do in the Jewish neighborhood. Well, I tell you one thing. Jews ain't letting immigrants come into their neighborhood and open up shops. Jewish politicians are not going to go along with that type of thinking. And I would dare you to go to votesmart.org. Go to votesmart.org and pull up a politician, a black politician, that's popular. Pull them up. Pull up Danny Davis in Illinois. Pull up what's the guy in South Carolina that brought Biden into the church? Pull up Elijah Cummings, who's dead now, but he was there forever. And look at their position on immigration. They for open borders. So how in the hell is that doing you any good? See, we can talk about the glorified stories that these news spots highlight.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's just nice. They come here so they can have a better life. They come here so they can have nice homes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's the thing about that, and this is what I'm talking about. You're always going to have these classes. You're going to have lower class. You're going to have higher class. Then you're going to have those in the middle. How in the heck do you get out of – you're not going to take immigrants and put them in the upper middle class and higher class communities. They're not going to shop at them corner stores. They're not going to do it.
I haven't seen – you know, one thing – I've never noticed. Now, I've seen plenty of black folks go to a Chinese restaurant, carry out all that. But I've never seen an Asian family go to a soul food joint.
Let me tell you something else, too. As I said, they are not going to set up shop in no upper class and no higher class community. All right? but they set up shop in these poor communities. Well, if you don't have dollars circulating in the poor community that allow people to have access to them in the performance of providing other services, then how are the people in the poor community ever going to get out of that? Think beyond the glory. Think beyond the emotion. Oh, that is so nice. They come here for a better life. You don't go to another country. Let me say this. If you took 100,000 blacks and you sent them to an African country, let's say go to Tessano right outside of Accra, and they applied their skills, would they be making it better or would they be taken from? They would be making the lives for the people better, not taken from. But here in the United States, you got immigrants that come here and take from what Americans have built. You're supposed to add on to what Americans have built, make life better for Americans. Now, you do have many that do that, and they happen to be coming from India and other places, and they are in professions like medical professions. That's helping to make this country better. But they shouldn't be able to stay here forever. You're supposed to fill that position with your own people.
Yeah, I noticed in a couple of hospitals, it used to be Providence Hospital in D.C., which I don't think is a hospital anymore. But a lot of the staff
there. That's some of the dumbest stuff I ever seen.
Were from India.
Well, L.A., all you got to do is go look up the data. We look up the data on the number of people shot by police. We look up the data, the number of people that's beat up by police. Look up the data on these facts, too. Look at your public schools, what they're turning out. Where are these young people going to? And earlier you had another one making compromises on $15 an hour. Minimum wage. Well, you raise minimum wage up to $15 an hour, what do you think they're going to do with the prices of the goods that they're selling? I've heard people already complaining that a box of shrimp fried rice costs a dollar more after COVID, or during COVID. So you look up...
Well,
you look up these politicians who support, it's not the senators. Senators don't address to these local and social. These U.S. senators, that's not their cup of tea. U.S. senators are basically controlled by your state representative, your state legislator. Your U.S. congressman that represent the district that you live in, like in Minneapolis. And I don't know who the congressman was there. But Baltimore was Elijah Cummings.
Right.
Look up his positions on Vote Smart if they're still there. Look up Danny Davis' positions and what he said and what he sponsored on VoteSmart.org or Ballotpedia. And they know that 99% of the people in a constituents is nowhere astute enough to do that. They go by a lot of fancy words, go by promises, go by feel-good slogans, lyrics. That's what they go by. And that's why come you see the continuing. You got politicians nowadays that's getting elected because of Black Lives Matter slogans. Defund the police. Police brutality.
Well, that's true. That's true. Pat,
more social
Frankie, hold
service.
On. Let me take another caller here while we still got time. 410, your mic is open. Wait, man, this is weird. Okay, wait a minute. It's all right. There it is. 410, your mic is open.
Hotel, brother, how you doing?
Fine.
Huh. Oh, boy. You know what, Brother L.A.? It's a good thing that you have your show on every day because I learn something new every day. You know, you think you know people, but the thing is, I'm just, you know, I have gotten so much knowledge since I've started listening to your show. And if I don't get it live, I go through the archives. I didn't know that those, well, I'm going to get back to your subject, but I didn't know that those policemen in St. Louis had gotten off of beating that cop, that undercover, that black undercover cop.
Yeah, I think two of them had.
Well, they got off. Well, the thing is this, you know. You know, Brother L.A., we only see the tip of the iceberg when it comes to, you know, looking at and analyzing other racial ethnic groups.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, we always see the finished or the end product. We don't see the makings of how things start. And the one thing that we miss, and I keep drumming this over and over and over again, is, see, those people have an identity and a culture. And I know that I get these naysayers, these woodheads. Well, the thing is, you blame everything on slavery. Well, look, we have proven over the course of years of me, you know, calling in on your show, that when you strip a people of their culture, their mores, their religion, and their identity, what happened is you have a bunch of zombies. You can put in their heads anything that you put in their heads. And after listening to your show over the years, I found out that what happens is, and if you listen to people carefully, we are trained white folks. We are trained lapdog white, well, white folk lapdogs. Whatever they see or whatever they think, that's the way we think. But we never analyze anything outside of the box. We always analyze things inside the box. Now, look, I looked at television the other day, one of those rare occasions, and what happened is they said that some of those immigrants coming from down south of the border pays mm-hmm. those smugglers $6,000 to get them into the United States. Now, if you're familiar with those economies down there, and I know you are, and I know my brother over there is, that's a lot of money for people. That's a lot of money for people in that economy. I don't know how much that equates to in our dollars.
Well, if it's like Mexico, matter of fact, I got a currency converter on my phone. Hold, let me look at but you're right, it's a lot. All right. All right, hold it, Mexico. Oh, let me take this one off. All right, Mexico, the Mexican peso right now is, where is it? Let's see. Oh, here it is. Okay. The one American dollar equals 20.31 of their pesos. So it multiplies by 20.
So $6,000 would be 72,000 of their pesos, right? Or something there.
You said what, $6,000?
Yeah.
$6,000 US dollars. Oh, it's more. It's 121,865 pesos.
Mexican pesos,
yes. That's a lot of money. For them,
that's
you're right.
That's a lot of money. Now, you couple that with, now, over here we have a bunch of Asiatic Indians that own some hotels. And we used to do some work for them. And they found out that our work was pretty good. So what happened is they always called us in to, you know, do over what was needed. You know, we had a contract with all of them in the area.
Uh-huh.
So out of curiosity, you know, me being those, I asked them, how do they do this? They say, well, what happened is when we come over here, our family, sends us over here with enough money to invest so that we can send money back because we're a poor family over in India. But what happens is when we get here, we take that money and we invest it in convenient malls and hotels. They say, that's how I got this hotel. And
right.
my cousin down the road there, that's how he got his hotel. And what we do is we send so much back home, we keep so much, and we reinvest it over again. We don't have that in our community because we don't have an identity. See, when you don't practice self-preservation and survival of the fittest, then what happens is you don't see a need to help your group survive. You don't see a need to reproduce yourself in human, like humans. Mm-hmm. And you don't see a need to multiply, produce, and reproduce those things that it takes for you to survive. So with that being the case, everybody jumps on the black man and the black woman. Man, they don't do this and they don't do that and they're riff-raff and all of this. Well, hell, look at where you come from. I think that black folks have done an amazing job of coming out of this morass, this bull. I mean, when you put up something, there's roadblocks in there to try and stop you. Or either back in the day, before you could get off your knees out of slavery, if you were doing something and you were successful, people would come in and do all types of things and pass all kinds of laws to stymie your growth. Now, look, this is a modern day. But you know what? The white society has gotten sophisticated. Look at the 40s that have come and put up voter suppression laws. You can't even give somebody a bottle of water that's standing out in the Georgia sunshine that's 90 and 100 degrees. That's illegal. You can't, they take away your voter's booths, and for every 1,000, you don't have enough. You got to stand in line 9 hours or so, and they put them all in white neighborhoods that don't need them. And then you come up, and when you start something, now, I'm gonna tell you this, and I got in the guy's butt about it. You know what? Every month, my store got inspected. He wanted to make sure that I had a 98 to almost 100 percentage safety record, which I didn't mind because, look, that was part of my strategy anyway. You know, I was taught, hey, look, you make sure that your place is clean, you give them a good competitive price, and you give them good customer service. So he couldn't beat me with that stick. So what happens is we come up and we think that black folks are trifling, like I've heard. And when these people come over here, they're coming over here based on what we were able to accomplish to make sure that they could come over here and not get harassed. I had to get in an African's ass. Talking about, well, I don't see why come you guys don't do this and don't do that. And my friend told him, say, well, look. The only reason your ass is over here is because we got the billy clubs upside our head so that you could come over here and you wouldn't have to take the shit that we took. And now you're coming up here trying to throw off on our ass. He said, we hadn't taken those hits with that billy club upside our damn head. They treat you just like they treat us. And then you have some idiot come in and say, well, you know, the Nigerians come over here and they're doing this and doing that. Well, the one sensible thing that I've heard is if they are so industrious and they're so smart about putting up businesses, why come they couldn't do it in their country? Why come the white man and the Lebanese and all these other foreigners, Arabs, are controlling their neighborhoods and got stores in their neighborhoods? So with that being said, look, I think we're doing a hell of a job. Can we do better? Yes, we should do better, and we can do better. But to sit there and think that we're making excuses and we are not doing a damn thing, I think we've done a hell of a job based on what we've had to go through putting up with this cracker and the stumbling blocks that he's put up in our way. And the thing is, we don't believe in grouping up together like those people. Those people don't have to go to a bank. Their culture says, hey, we don't want a bank. But our culture has been stripped from us. We could use a SUSU and do the same thing they're doing. There's other African, there's other African ways that they raise money. And the thing is, because we've been stripped of our culture, we don't know anything about it. And we haven't put anything in place to show these young folk how it can be done. And I say we, because, you know, we're always sitting back and complaining and criticizing black folk, but we ain't getting off our ass to do a damn thing to try and teach them the ins and outs of how to put up a business or how to mentor
them. Well, let me ask you this, because you mentioned identity. What if, because you got plenty of black Baptists, okay?
Yeah.
Let's use that as the identity, black Baptists. Well, yeah, black Baptists. That, and I'll give you an example. Now, when I go to Taft, Oklahoma, Taft is in Muskogee County. Taft doesn't have any hotels, no accommodations. They used to, but when a great migration happened, all that left town. So they don't have any place for accommodations. Now, so when I go to Taft, I've had to stay in Muskogee. That's like 15-20 minute drive away. And then the motels that are there, at least the ones I know about, they got like a strip, and motel after motel after motel, and basically all those are owned by probably the last name Patel. They're either Indian or Pakistani, one of the two. But now my question is, there are plenty of black churches that we can use as an idea. What do you think is the void there? Because they can put together money to get a sanctuary. They can put together money to get a church van. But what about something along the lines of when we have visitors in town, or when there's some type of convention, let's pool our money and get a motel going, or a string of motels. What about that? How could we get that? Because that is an identity, black Baptist.
Yes.
And they do get together for conventions.
They do? Yeah, they do.
Yeah,
they have
conventions, but, now outside of that, on an entrepreneurial thing is, or in other words, okay, what is the Southern Baptist Convention? One of those Baptist conventions is mostly black. Okay, getting together and let's get a chain of, let's start with a McDonald's. And then, so we can employ people in our church. And then, maybe eventually build up to a chain. Or a gas station. Start off with one. And because the money's there.
Oh,
among
yeah.
black Baptists.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's the mentality that's missing.
You said it. That's the key right there. That's the key. See, we think of ourselves as Christians, as Baptists. We don't think of ourselves as a community. Now, all of those people in any given community, regardless of what church they go to or what denomination they're in, they're black. And last time I checked, I don't think you can live on this planet if you don't eat on a semi-regular basis.
Yeah,
but the thing
once
is,
a day.
Well, I'm just saying, look, when I get up in the morning, most of the time I want something to eat. I don't know about anybody
else.
Right,
yeah, well, most people do.
Yeah, so with that, look, depending on where you live at, especially in rural areas, I don't know about town, but my car doesn't run unless I put some gasoline in it or I need some
water. That's the same in Taft. People got cars in Taft, but they had to go to Muskogee to fill it up.
And with that being said, I looked at that map of all of those townships, and they're in a pretty good, radius. Those towns
they're close in proximity. They're striking distance to larger areas, but the towns I've been in, which is Taft, Summit, and Tallahassee. And then Redbird's not too far from there, neither is Rennesville. But for whatever reason now, they don't, once again, there's a Baptist church in each one of those places.
Yeah, or whatever, there's a church. But my thing, and look, all of those people know each other, and look, most of those people go to each other's churches. Some of them marry people in different churches. So there is a link to all of those religious facilities you're talking about. But all I'm saying is this, is that when you don't have an identity, and because you don't have an identity, you don't practice self-preservation and survival of the fittest, you don't see the need to do those things you're talking about. You don't have a requirement to do that because you've been trained that, hey, look, you know what? All I got to do is go to Walmart, or all I got to do is just go to Piggly Wiggly, everywhere the hell you're going at. And Luke, I think Bishop Luke Edwards proved, say, well, look, you know what? We got this thing here. We got a need, too. But you never have that need. And then we come with this idiotic thing about I'm a conservative and I'm a liberal. I'm a Republican or I'm a Democrat, and I can't deal with you. Just like church folks say, I can't deal with you because you're Muslim or you're AMEZ, and I'm a COGIC. See, we get wrapped up in this foolishness. And what happens is these foreigners comes in and fills the void. Now, my thing is this here. Look, you know what? We're going by fried chicken from a Korean, and we created the process of how we created that cuisine. We don't even have sense enough. We're not tied to our culture enough to even put up a chicken shack with something that we created. See, that's our creation. And the thing is, Brother L.A., when you don't have an identity and you can't organize around your identity because you've been trained to see things through a white person's eyes to say that you niggas don't need to get together, you better not get together. See, that's a carryover. Now, we can make excuses
Billy,
that it's
not
made. Do you
remember a place on, on Reisterstown Road? It was a black restaurant / carryout. I look at it as a carryout, where they had lines out the door. It was a black-owned place. Was that on Reisterstown Road? You know where, Reisterstown and Park Heights, the Park Sausage Complex. Remember that? You know that area?
Yeah, who?
The Park Sausage Complex.
Yeah, I know where that is, yeah.
All right. I think that's Reisterstown Road. If you go up Reisterstown Road north,
right,
to the right, there was a place. Man, I forgot the name of that joint. But they had, it wasn't a Korean place. This was a black business.
Right.
Where black folks were lined outside the door all the time. They only had one location,
right,
to my knowledge. Are they still in business?
What's his name, Kweezy Mfumi, or what his name, son bought that, because the boy, the woman died. It was a fish joint, right?
Yeah, it was a fish joint, exactly.
Yeah, the woman died and left it to her son, and he got on drugs and mismanaged the place, and the Kweezy Mfumi and his son was trying to revive it, but it never was the same after she died. She left that boy
Places like that could be franchised. Or, now you know in that location, being Baltimore what it is, once again, going back to the religious identity, the Baptist somebody, Kojic AME, could have said, let's go into business, and because that place was a gold mine.
And you know what, with the right management, it still could. I haven't been there in a while. But look, Brother L.A., I don't know if you've ever been to these church dinners or not. Who cooks any better than grandma in the church?
Well, that's true. And grandma is now, grandma is also employed by a lot of these Asian businesses that sell hot meals to in black neighborhoods. They sell the smothered steak, the smothered chicken, the smothered pork chops, the candied yams. They cook that.
That's right. They
get grandma, black grandma has been hired by the Koreans or the Asians.
That's right. So, but the key thing here is that we're not black. We're anything but we're taught to disrespect, disown, and be ashamed of our ethnic of our race. And that blends right into going in and you're not practicing self-preservation and survival of the fittest. Because, look, everybody's using our culture to get rich. God damn it. I mean, look, I used to go into a Chinese restaurant. They don't eat fried food. They don't eat fried chicken, you know.
No, they don't.
They might eat it, but the thing is, that's not their main dish when they're at their house.
You know
that's
what? I've never seen them eat it. I see them eat, but what they sell is not what they're eating.
That's right. But look, another thing now, we cook rice just like they do. Kids was cultivating rice just as far back or longer than they were. You know, but the thing is, when you don't have a connection to your culture, and then you have this poison in your mind that you're no good and you're trifling, and that, you know what, you better not do this based on what you saw in history with those sundown towns and everything else, burning down whole neighborhoods and everything, race riots in your neighborhood. That has an effect, and the thing is, we never overcome that. Now, some people say, he's just using that for an excuse. No, it's not a fucking an excuse. That's reality. And the thing is, for people like me and people like that calls in on your show, we see a problem. But we can't figure out how to solve it. Or if we try to solve it, we try to solve it with a white man's approach. And you can't do that.
Well,
and the other thing, and I want to get off this. You know
okay.
what? If we don't invest in putting up schools to teach our black kids to survive, then you know what? That's an insult. You know what? We have failed our children. Damn the public schools, charter schools, or magnet schools. We know what it takes to live out here based on our experience. We should be financing those schools to make sure that we teach them all the stuff you're talking about, how to act when you're approached by the law, how you can go and put up businesses. Here's some skills you can use, life skills you can use, and here's some technical skills you can use or either STEMs that will give you more money than bouncing a ball. But we won't do that. No, we'll sit back and we'll criticize people. And we'll adopt a white boy's approach to it and say, well, you know what, we need charter schools or we need magnet schools. Hell, the hell with that. We need black schools that teach black
tomorrow,
people to be black.
Tomorrow we have a guest calling in, so Robert Miner, man, if I need to give him a call in a few minutes. On that note, we're going to let you have last word, Beasley. And like I said, each week we're going to do at least one part live stream a week on 11,000 kilometers to the promised land and black neighborhoods. So thanks for bringing that up yesterday. Everyone has a good rest of your day.